Welcome to our Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with authors of many different writing styles. I'm Lucinda Hawksley, and today we're looking at writing about health and lifestyle. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you want to find out more, go to www.goldster.co.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's Inside Story with Laura Payne, the author of this gorgeous book, Under the Lime Tree, Nine Steps to a Mindful Life Without Meditating. Laura, welcome to Goldster. Thank you so much for coming along.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me. Looking forward to, as always, chatting about mindfulness and associated topics.
So tell us, first of all, we hear the word mindfulness all the time, but what is it?
Yes, I always think it's perhaps best to tell people what it isn't sometimes, and how I actually came into mindfulness. I realised I had a problem when I was working. My kids were then quite young. Well, in fact, they were very young. And I got the kids ready to go out. We were going to the shops. And I thought I'd got all my office finery on because I was running a business at the time, and I was sort of well togged up, and drove the kids round to school. And my young eldest daughter at the back goes, Mummy, why are we at school? And I sort of turned around and thought, she's going on about it. So I turned around and thought, oh my God, the kids haven't got their school uniforms on. And then I looked again and she said, Mummy, it's Saturday, we're going to the shops. And I realised I was on complete autopilot, and I had, you know, I was just doing my normal thing, getting up in the morning, getting the kids ready, taking them to school, going to work. And I had completely missed, of course, that it was Saturday. My kids hadn't, because they hadn't got school uniform on. And I then realised I had a big problem. And for me, that sums up mindfulness. It's how do we step out of autopilot and actually bring awareness, proper awareness, to our lives. And it's not just about, you know, meditating on the floor, hence the book, because there are other important things and aspects to mindfulness apart from just thinking it's about zenning neatly cross-legged and perfectly still on the floor. It's how do you live that stillness and that presence every day of your life is really, really tough. And so in the nine chapters of the book, I look at different ways of finding mindfulness in your everyday life. And then I have a sneaky chapter 10, which is about how do you meditate? And, you know, if you think about it, meditation is just sitting on the floor, which is anybody, and I'm sure a lot of you have tried it out, it is not the easiest thing to do, just sitting there and, you know, sitting with the aggro of your thoughts is perhaps one of the toughest things ever to do.
I find it incredibly hard. I just cannot switch my mind off. And whenever I try and meditate, I find myself getting very, very stressed about it. So the fact that your book said without meditating was great to me. So tell us what would you suggest to someone like me? How should they start practicing mindfulness?
Well, let's do an exercise now. Shall we all do an exercise? Yeah. I mean, this is one of my favourite ones. Chapter 9 is about good beginnings and good endings. And so a good beginning, and I think this is important for all of us, and I often teach this, is let's arrive. And we haven't arrived properly, as we all know. We either, you know, whether you're going to work or whatever event you're going to, you get yourself quite sort of slightly jumpy about it all. And we forget to centre and just bring ourselves back to ourselves. So I'm going to invite you, Lucinda, and everybody else.
Yes, I hope everyone's going to join me in this.
Yeah, join us in Arrival. Okay. Title of a good film.
That's an ABBA album, isn't it?
Yeah. Possibly. So let's just, and I'm going to invite you all just to, and you don't have to, just close your eyes and sit back in your seat, and let's just close our eyes. And if you don't like closing your eyes, just find a spot on the floor in front of you so you can lower your eyes. And let's just find our feet on the floor. So legs uncrossed, feet flat on the floor. That's a good grounding position. And a nice little tip, instead of trying to find your feet on the floor, feel the floor coming to meet your feet. It's got a very different sensation, hasn't it, about it. And then just allow your hands, perhaps put one on top of the other on your lap. And just let's feel the chair coming in to support us and hold us. And just centering and slowing down now, finding yourself just sitting here. And a bit to use the breath as anchor. Just feel the air coming in your nostrils, cold. And then on the out-breath, finding it warm in the nostrils. And just staying with that for a couple of breaths. Giving yourself permission to stop and giving yourself permission just to be here, letting everything else go. When you're ready, you have arrived, coming back into the room.
How wonderful. That was a really gorgeous moment. I hope that everybody else managed to do that as well. I'd love to hear from you, by the way, if anyone's got any experiences of mindfulness or how you just found that exercise, please do, as always, feel free to put things in the chat. That was beautiful, Laura. Thank you.
Thank you.
So after your trip to the school, what did you start to do to make your life different?
I sold my business. It was quite radical. I had been going to yoga anyway, which had been my initial introduction to mindfulness. I had a superb yoga teacher, and then she left and was replaced by another super yoga teacher, both of whom I'm still in touch with. And I basically sold my business and restructured my life. And I looked at what I'd always wanted to do. I'd always wanted to go back to university and study, which is what I did. And it just changed things around so I could spend more time with my children. I know it feels, I was still working, but I just changed the format of how I was working. And I was also really radical at a later time in my life as well. My marriage had broken up. My kids were then obviously a lot older. And I then decided that I was going to completely change and overhaul my life then, and stopped working as a consultant and decided to retrain as a therapist. And probably the best decision I ever made. I was 50 and everybody said to me, what are you doing? You know, retraining again. And I thought, well, you know, it's only 3-4 years. And trust me, those years were really quite quickly. Yeah. And I then got involved with mindfulness properly through the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, which was then run by Mark Williams. I'm going to stretch across and get his book, because this also is such an influential book. He's probably, Mark Williams ran the Oxford Mindfulness Centre. He was a psychologist and a professor there.
And just for the recording, that's called Mindfulness Finding Yes. Peace in a...
Yes, so that's called Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Finding Peace in a Frantic World. So Mindfulness, A Practical Guide to Finding Peace in a Frantic World. And that is written by Mark Williams and one of his proteges, Dan Penman, who had been a journalist. And he set up the core 8-week mindfulness program in the UK, based on the work by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was the main modern-day proponent of mindfulness, which he kicked off in the 1980s. And Kabat-Zinn describes mindfulness in his book as paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally, which I think is quite an interesting aspect of it, to things as they are, not what we want them to be, not what they were. So it's parking all the should-haves, could-haves, all the what I call the conditional tense stuff, and just seeing how things are. So when we're sitting meditating and we're struggling with all these obtrusive thoughts, welcome them in rather than trying to think, oh God, I'm meant to be sitting here in peace and getting rid of these thoughts. They're there. They're part of you. You can't, it makes it worse if we don't bring them in. And that's what being mindful is. Can you sit with any activity of sort of thinking that's going on in your brain?
We've got lots of messages coming in, and what you just said really replies to somebody who said, I try to meditate, but I find that I know that if I know there are things that need attention, my mind wanders to the tasks.
Oh, I know, isn't it awful? Well, I've been doing this for donkey's years, and I tell you, I've had such a stressful couple of weeks, and I tend to do my meditation every day at around 5:30, and I find having a time that fits in with your schedule, that you really make it part of your schedule, is important. Otherwise, you're in the, oh, I could do that later. We all know. That's not going to happen. And so
I change done before you meditate, basically.
Yeah, or not. You know, 5:30 is the meditation time for me. So I sat down and I could just feel that whole buzzy mindset. It was almost impossible, but I thought, no, I've got to sit with it. This is what's in my mind. I've got varying techniques of getting rid of some of that stuff, none of which I would add was working at that point. But in the end, you sort of plateau out. And the more you do it, the more the brain thinks, no, I can let go of this stuff. And then you plateau out and you find that sweet spot, for want of a better description.
We've got lots of comments here. Somebody says, I so want to be able to meditate. I loved the exercise that you did at the beginning. Somebody else says, I particularly loved letting the ground come to your feet. Mm. A very different sensation indeed. I can absolutely echo that, as has somebody else said exactly the same. I thought that was a fascinating sensation. We've got one here. I try deep breathing in to the count of four through my nose and out through my mouth when I'm in bed and have difficulty falling asleep. It really helps. Great tip. Thank you for that. I also have an app that I find really good during the day. Oh, how interesting.
Good. There are lots.
So many great apps out there at the moment. Yeah. And we have a comment about the Goldster mindfulness meditation on Goldster on Mondays with Ellie, who is excellent, and so is Jess. So there we are. Fantastic recommendations. Right, here's the message to you. A very good friend of mine is in a lot of pain. Is there anything that will help her, please? Can mindfulness have any applications for that?
Well, cue Jon Kabat-Zinn, because that's exactly how Jon Kabat-Zinn got into mindfulness. Like me, in late 1970s, early 80s, he was doing yoga. He found meditation through yoga. And he was running a pain management clinic, I think in Massachusetts. There are some YouTube videos out there of him talking about this. And he decided that when he himself was suffering from back pain or whatever, and he found that in meditation or after meditation, it really eased up. So he decided to introduce mindfulness meditation to the class, the group of people in this pain management clinic. And that was what started off his research, because they all reported the most amazing differences by being mindful, not just mindful meditation, but sort of taking on board some of the mindfulness exercise that Jon Kabat-Zinn was developing. Some of them are really old practices, some of them are new ones. And later on, I think, as we discuss, Lucinda, we'll do the 3-minute breathing space, which I think if you take nothing else away from today, that is always such a good practice. It's more of the modern day, from modern day movement, but it's, I think, probably one of the best introductions by them. And the number of times I've done it, and we'll do it later, it has made a significant difference. So it's a bit like a rival, but it's an extension of arrival, and it makes such a difference to people's lives. So we can do that
exercise together later on in this session. That would be brilliant. We have a comment here from somebody who says, in answer to the person who asked that question, I was taught if you put your attention on the area of pain, it reduces it, and it definitely works for me. I assume that is while meditating, perhaps. But thank you very much for that. That's very helpful. I love the way the Goldster community really helps each other and comes up with these questions and solutions. It's wonderful.
Just an echo to that, also, and we'll do this in the 3-minute breathing space. A really good tip, and this is again out of the yoga, thousands of year old yoga community, is breathing into the area of pain. So you actually take your attention there and you also take your breath there. And we'll play around with that when we do the breathing space.
So let's move on to multitasking. Tell us what you
think. Well, I often say to people, if you just stop and think, and I bet some of you are listening to me and Lucinda, but you're probably on your phone now, or checking up a few emails, or perhaps flicking through a book, or your mind's wandered. We all think we can multitask, but thanks to the Harvard Mindfulness Labs and a couple of other research labs in the States, I hate to say this, women, but, you know, we think we're better multitaskers than men. And there might be an aspect that our frontal cortex can process information a little bit quicker, but none of us can actually multitask, really. And if we think we're multitasking, we're just dampening down other functions. And we all know this, you know, you're talking to your partner while everyone's watching the TV, and you know they're not listening. You just know they're not listening to you because they've got the audio function of the brain up on sort of higher to sort of block you out. And there's been some really interesting research done on all of this, mainly by, I was going to get the name of the institute, I can never remember their full name, but at the MIT in Massachusetts, but it's known as the Miller Laboratory after Earl K. Miller, who is the sort of professor of neuroscience at MIT. And he's basically discovered that brains are not wired to multitask well and can only take the world in bits and chunks. And so as a result of that, we are exhausting ourselves, and they've come to the conclusion that we're, particularly with the growth of the mobile phone and tablets, but mainly the phone, that we're all putting ourselves almost in a state of ADD, ADHD, so hypertension deficit disorder, and they call it pseudo-ADD. And when you watch children, you get a sense of that, that over the years, our attention span, our ability to hold information has decreased so much. I think in 2013, so 10 years ago, our attention span was roughly 8 seconds. Well, advertisers who this is important for, and also filmmakers know that in the main, our attention span is probably around 4 seconds.
Gosh, that's incredible.
4 seconds. You know, that means that if you think that, I did a calculation once, thinking to myself, well, if we're only fully present and we live for another 30 years, I think, you know, even if we're only fully present, say, 2 hours a day, and actually I think that's a ridiculous amount as well now, we've technically only got 6 years and 3 months left to live, actually fully live. And but the ADD part of it, I find very worrying. And I know teachers do, because children aren't able to retain and concentrate, hold their attention for long periods of time, which is a real struggle, obviously, if you're a teacher, and also asking children to receive and retain information. But I think it slipped up into older age groups. I was out with a couple of friends who were older than me, and so they were late 60s, early 70s. And as I've been with a couple of teenagers, we were out for lunch, they could not, every time their phone pinged, they had to just check who it was. And it was not at all important. And so, we've all become in this sort of multitasking sort of unable to concentrate mode. So I think one of, you know, I was talking earlier to you about having some top tips. One of my top tips would be, dare you, now this is a challenge, dare you actually switch your phone off during the day, not at nighttime. I think that's actually essential. But dare you switch your phone off, even if it's just for 15 minutes once a day. And just note.
Members here, please do put in the chat, do you do that regularly or do you feel that you need to? Because I know that I need to. And in fact, that was one of my New Year's resolutions that I've barely managed to keep, which is to turn my phone off. Sometimes extremely hard when you work freelance as well. You're always terrified of turning your phone off. But I think it's something that we absolutely should all be doing. Just to say, we've got a great comment in the chat about multitasking. This is possibly the best type of multitasking. I currently have to look after my daughter's puppy while I'm listening to you. Well, that sounds like a joyous multitasking. Very envious. So having that, giving up your phone for a while in a day, having that moment of stillness, tell us about what that does to you as a human being when you give yourself that gift.
Wow. Well, a lot of it is an extension of, can we sit and meditate? But just to give ourselves a moment of stillness is such a big permission. And I would say, you know, just look at what happens to your thought waves. And let's rephrase that. Just stop and think about, when I suggested you switch your phone off, can you tune into actually emotionally how you felt about that? Because for most of us, it's like, slight moment of panic around it, because we've become so, not obsessed, but it's so much part of our lives. And it does destroy any moment of stillness. And so a part of mindfulness is looking at what comes up when you're asked to do things, where the worries are, where the anxieties are. How can you change your behavior? And as a result, change your mindset. I think that's the key thing. In the mindfulness movement, it likes to say that, can you see your thoughts as clouds in the sky? You're the sky. The thoughts are the bits that keep passing by. You are not your thoughts. Or the other one is waves on the sea. You're the sea. You're not the waves. They're part of you, but they will pass. And sometimes they'll be big and sometimes they'll be small, like clouds. So it's helping you see that you are something separate in many ways from your thoughts. You don't have to be determined by your mindset. You can change your mindset.
We have a few comments here. So we've got one person who says, I worry that I'll miss an urgent phone call, which I think is something we all fear. Another woman says, the short attention span is quite frightening. I've been with friends who constantly check phones and we're all over 70. I am trying hard to cut down on my phone usage. And someone else who says, I keep mine on silent all day, but I still check it multiple times. Oh, yes. I just forget mine's on silent. And then I wonder why I haven't had a response to whatever I was expecting. So now somebody has a question for you here. Can you please explain why FOMO exists?
Yeah. Well, I think that fear of missing out, I think the phone is part of that, you know. It almost needs like a double F FOMO, you know, fear of phone missing out in some way. Because, yeah, we do. What is that about? It's something to do with the notion of belonging, how we connect with others, whether we are isolated. Some of this material is very, very primal. It's very much part of our survival mechanism. How do we belong to the outside world? And for a lot of people now, particularly post-pandemic, you know, this, the phone, has been our link and is increasingly the main link. You know, it's almost become an oxymoron to say the mobile phone. Who uses a landline anymore? You know, this is our link to the outside world, as well as our laptop or our tablets. And so there will be a massive attachment, to use psychotherapy talk, attachment to this as a form of being attached to others. The problem is it's become the primary attachment rather than the people themselves.
And everybody else expects you to be on it all the time. I remember a couple of years ago, pre-pandemic, I missed a phone call because I was in the basement of the college that I teach at, and you can't get signal there. I was in that basement for 20 minutes. And I've missed a phone call and I came up and it was from Channel 4 asking if I'd take part in a TV program. I was very excited. I rang them back and they said, oh, no, you weren't available. So we've just booked someone else. Now, this wasn't asking me to go on that day. This was asking me to be an interviewee weeks hence. But because I literally wasn't there in that moment, they'd already gone to somebody else. It was extraordinary. Yeah. So I think that's the problem is that society has got to the point that they just expect that you are there at all times.
Yeah, and it's this pacing up, which is part of autopilot, part of multitasking, and it's easy to get caught up in that. Can we reward ourselves? Because in the end, this is about wellness. This is about good mental health. This is about finding stillness at certain times in our life. So we slow this mechanism down so we get more out of life. And so can we just reward ourselves with a 15-minute switch off, possibly over lunchtime or whenever, but just noticing the panic that might arise around that and seeing whether you can just sit with that panic, and because it then stops controlling you. You find a new mindset. You then, part of doing this on a regular basis is you then start dealing with some of these anxious behaviours that become very subtly controlling.
I have a very good example here of somebody who said, I'm happy to do without my phone, especially if I'm reading or painting and I don't want to be interrupted. So she really has the right idea, doesn't she?
Mm. Loving it. Applause all round.
So, your top three mindfulness tips. We've got the switch off your phones and tablets at least once a day and definitely when you go to bed.
Yeah.
What about others?
Well, one of my favourites is stop being boring. You know, we get, again, part of an extension of autopilot. You know, God, how boring was I just, you know, driving my kids to school on a Saturday. But just other areas. I remember once, which is what inspired the book, was that I was on a retreat, and which are sort of features of my life now. I like to go off on a silent mindfulness retreat. And when I was on the retreat that inspired this book, I realised, and I got very agitated, that everybody looked like sort of calm, like angels, and I was there stewing. I couldn't settle. I thought I wasn't doing it well enough. All my old sort of ghosts, for want of a better description. And there was one day where it was in France, this retreat, and it was this most beautiful chateau. So we were in this outbuilding where it was being held, but we all had to go back to the chateau. Sounds really grand, doesn't it? For a retreat. You had to go back there for the dining room, which was probably the best food I've ever had on a retreat. Normally it's quite sparse, but this was just amazing. Anyway, it was dinner time and we were all in the sort of meeting room and we had to go across dining room, and it was chucking down with rain. And we were all cowering there, all upset. People were upset they didn't have an umbrella and they were going to get wet. And I suddenly thought to myself, what are we going on about? We get wet. Does it really matter? And how, as you age, these mindsets, sometimes you lose the ability, in other words, to play. Kids would have been out there running around in the rain and jumping in the puddles. So I thought, I'm going to be 8. So I went outside and danced in the rain, and a couple of other people then joined me. And I thought to myself, yes, Laurie, you're so boring. You doesn't have to be boring. You can embrace these things. And I had such a fabulous time. I really enjoyed the meal. I write about it in the book. The softness, I had bare feet. I took my socks and shoes off. The softness of the grass on my feet. Oh, it was amazing. It was a real sensory moment. And so I've thought a lot about how boring we are. And so a tip, and it's the start of the year, but you can do it in any time of the year, is somebody had given me a lovely calendar, you know, one of those old school calendars, because like everybody else, I keep my calendar on the phone. And it had a little box for each day. So, you know, you turn over the month and you hang it on the wall. And I decided that each day I would find something unique. And it became a wonderful project during the year to make sure that every day I did something that I'd never, ever done before. And you'd be surprised, actually. Most days we do something that we've never done before. And what became an interesting challenge was if it was a day that I thought, oh my God, I've just done the same thing that I did yesterday, I would manufacture something that was different. So, for instance, I walked home a different way than I would have walked home before.
And we've got a question saying, what sort of things did you do?
There we go. Silly things. Walk home. I would buy something different for dinner that I'd never eaten before. I would pick up a book that I perhaps hadn't, that I knew I wanted to read, that I hadn't read before. A good one for all of you, a good one if you've never done this before, and this is hilarious, so this is really young as well, is try brushing your teeth with the other hand. These are warning. It comes with a health warning. It gets very messy because we can actually do it the same way. So it's a great way of just slowing this all down and challenging yourself. It's something really silly and also really good fun.
Well, people liked that idea. I think there's going to be a lot of people brushing their teeth with the other hand. I have tried to do that. It's an absolute mess.
You have a towel ready.
I wish I were ambidextrous, but I'm really not. So I think before we, because I want us to go on to another area of your work, as well as this wonderful book, which is to talk a little bit about dream therapy. But I would quite like us to do the 3-minute breathing space, or would you rather do that at the very end?
Why don't we do that towards the end? Because I think that's quite a good one. And, you know, the whole dream, the dream world is almost an extension. I see someone's here, I might get paste in my eyebrow. You will.
We also had a funny comment. Someone said that she couldn't multitask, and so she couldn't listen to us for a while because she had to go and order the online the book by Mark Williams that you recommended. So she had to tune out from the chat for a couple of minutes.
There you go. I think that Mark will be very happy with that. He has now retired, but I'm sure he'll be happy with his royalties.
He'll be back further than dropping the children at school. So you began your life as a journalist, is that right? Is that the beginning?
I did, yes.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit, in a nutshell, your career and how it brought you then to retraining as a therapist.
Oh, gosh. Probably like a lot of people listening, I have reinvented myself several times. I started life as a journalist, then I went and ran a comms consultancy, PR comms consultancy, then gave that all up and went back into freelance journalism, which involved radio, TV and things like that. And then I gave that up to become a psychotherapist. And I, as you said earlier, I do a lot of work around dreams. I'm part of the Dreams Research Institute, and we are interested in all things to do with dreams. We're about to launch our own podcast called The Dream Boat, The Dream Boat Podcast.
Name,
I know. It's going to be, we're recording on a canal boat at Little Venice. And so you might hear ducks in the background, but it feels appropriate recording on water because it's a bit like the dream state. And there are a lot of similarities between mindfulness and dreaming because it's about a form of consciousness. Can we change our consciousness? And the closest all of us know about changing consciousness and what sort of, it's almost a bit like a radio frequency. Can we dial it up? Can we dial it down? When we dream, that is a change of consciousness, obviously. And different dreams are also slight changes on the sort of, on the bandwidth of dreaming. And I've become really fascinated in dreaming as therapy. It's, I think the Jungians will know this, that the psyche constantly is throwing images at us, and particularly in the dream world. And I always say to clients, it's like the psyche knocking on the door, offering you a way of change, a way of finding a new mindset.
We have an interesting question here. I don't even know if you'll be able to answer this. Morning dreams seem far more memorable. How does it all work, please?
Oh, well done. You are bang on right. That is the right question.
Well done, that person.
It is. If any of you have got a Fitbit or, you know, smartwatch that tracks your sleep, you will notice that normally just before you wake up, you have what's known as REM sleep, R-E-M, rapid eye movement sleep, which is the bit that they know when we're dreaming. So very often, we will remember our dreams just before we wake, and they're often the most powerful dreams as well. So if I'm working with clients or dream groups or just talking about it generally, the dreams that people have when they are just before they wake or when waking become the most significant, and usually are the most significant dreams for the psyche. A lot of people have changed their relationship with dreaming and remember dreams better because during the pandemic, a lot of people weren't having to wake up to an alarm clock anymore. Mm. And so you're in that sort of, again, consciousness, that sort of mindful zone between sleep and wake and REM sleep and light sleep and waking, which is such a fertile area for the imagination. A lot of artists, writers will tell you that it's that zone that is so creative. And for a lot of you, you probably know that it is in that period where you can probably find solutions to problems, creative ways forward. It's a very powerful part of sleep, that bit, first thing in the morning and waking.
Thank you. We have another question here. What are your thoughts on lucid dreaming, please? I think, could you explain to everyone what lucid dreaming actually is?
I love lucid dreaming. In fact, on the podcast, we'll talk to somebody who calls the lucid dream the white whale of dreaming, because it's some people can do it and some people can't, and spend their life trying to have a lucid dream. So a lucid dream is when you know you're dreaming. And that sounds really silly, but you know you're dreaming enough to then engage and change the dream. So people love to try. Most lucid dreamers kick off first by flying. You know, you find you have this great ability to fly, walk through walls, have sex with whoever you want to have sex with in the dream. That's a big one for a lot of lucid dreamers. For some people, it's a very powerful and clearly a powerful experience. And in therapy, you know, for people who lucid dream, you can go in and change the outcome. You can change your mindset. You can change how you feel about things. It's good work for people who might have regular nightmares. It's so part of the dream therapy that we research at the DRI, the Dream Research Institute, is we look at a technique known as the waking dream technique, which is taking lucid dreaming and taking it and using it as a tool. So you don't actually have to dream. You work with the dream therapist, and we will then take you back through the dream. Obviously you're awake, but we put you in a sort of, I suppose, a mindfulness sort of state, and we then get you to tell us the dream, and you go back in and we show you ways of perhaps changing it and engaging with the dream while you're awake. And that's
a way of dealing with recurring nightmares, for example, if anybody's watching this or listening to this and they're not sure what to do.
Yeah. Very much so, or just a dream generally, because as I said earlier, the psyche is brilliant at throwing images at us, which is what dreams are about, wanting to be known and offering ways of healing.
We have a comment here, and I wonder if you can help them out. I have lucid dreams, but when it reaches the pleasurable part, I wake up. It's so annoying.
I agree.
How can this person stay in their lucid dream, Laura? Do you have any?
Well, yes, there's a lot of training techniques. There are some very good books out there of exercises you can do so that you don't wake. The pioneer of modern day lucid dreaming is Stephen LaBerge, that's LaBerge, who is the guy who started in the 70s studying this as a professor a modern day book, which I also, I don't think I've got it here in front of me, who somebody's going to come and talk on our podcast, is Robert Wagoner, W-A-G-G-O-N-E-R. And he's one of the leading lucid proponents of lucid dreaming in the States. And Robert's got some great techniques in that book of what you can do to sort of try and stay with it.
We have a question here. What kind of psychotherapist are you, and are dreams your speciality?
This is a mouthful, isn't it? All psychotherapists have their modality, known as their modality. I am a transpersonal, integrative psychotherapist. And yes, dreams are one of my main areas of one of the main tools I use. Transpersonal means, I always say to clients, that I'm interested in you, mind, body, and soul. And integrative means I've learned all the varying theories and modalities, but I don't force you into my modality. I use them like tools in the box.
We have a question here. Why do we have recurring dreams and don't seem to be able to shake off certain people and or situations?
Yeah, great question. A lot of that is because we haven't done the work on them, which is why dream therapy can be really important. And it could be that you say to yourself, before you go to sleep, I want to change this. I remember, and we probably all had these dreams as kids, but I remember dreams of teeth falling out. That was a regular recurring dream. Being in the swimming pool and struggling with it, that was another recurring dream for me, which when I started to deal with that, I learned how to lucid dream on the back of that particular, on that dream. That was what was often the precursor to becoming lucid for me. I remember for years not doing very well in my A-levels. It was a recurring dream, the A-level failure or the A-level bad mark dream. And what changed that for me was obviously my psyche felt constantly unfulfilled in some way. What changed it was when I went back as an adult student and did my first degree. And then I stopped having that dream, which I thought I find hugely significant.
Very significant. We have a question here. If a person can't remember their dreams, is it possible to do hypnosis to discover the answers?
Yeah, that is one of the ways. And again, so if we see this as bandwidths of consciousness, like mindfulness, like meditation, like dreaming, lucid dreaming is a slight twist of the dial, hypnotherapy, I think, very much falls within that line. And I think there's an interesting crossover between the Dream Research Institute's Waking Dream Technique and hypnosis, because you are slightly, a bit like when I was doing Arrival, you are slightly, you're changing you're changing, well, people would say, you're changing the brainwave state, which again is hypnosis is about. Some people use that as a way into lucid dreaming. And so some people use varying relaxation exercises and slightly hypnosis style exercises to then go into the lucid dream state.
Got another question here. Is it significant if we dream in colour or in monochrome?
Good question. Like all questions about dreams. They're all really interesting, aren't they? I would need to know more about you, I think, to answer that question. And one of the questions you might need to ask yourself if you are recording your dreams, note when they are colour and when they are monochrome. Because that can be quite sort of telling about your mind state or how you feel about the material that's in the dream. And one of the things that we're very keen on at the Dream Research Institute is to help people understand that you can buy all of these symbology books and, you know, the notion of there's some universal dream guide. But in the end, it's your associations with these symbols that become absolutely important. And you can do enough work on your own symbology to work out what those varying things mean for you. So this is the notion of Freudian association. So what do you associate with colour? What do you associate with black and white? And that would be where I would start with that.
There's a lot of questions coming in asking specific things about dreams. And I think that answer is probably answered, that each one of those people asking what does this particular dream mean is probably very relevant specifically to them. And you would need to work with them individually, I guess. One is an interesting thing here. What would be the meaning behind recurrent dreams of dead people when one is ill? Is that a question you can answer without knowing that person individually?
Well, that's interesting. When are you meaning that when you're ill, you're dreaming about dead people? There'll be a death fear in there, obviously. You know, heck, you know, I talk about this in my book, actually. What would you do if this was your last day? Our preoccupation with death, you know, as I always say, you know, we're born into death. We know we're going to die. It's inevitable. And we have all sorts of mechanisms to deal with impending death. Irvin Yalom, one of the main existential therapists, has written a fabulous book on this. And we all have our pact. Is it, are we going to hope that we think will help us elude death in some way, having a legacy, writing books, something that's left behind that gives us continuity, having children. We all have our own technique for avoiding death. But in the end, we're not going to avoid it. And I tend to say when I'm working with clients, the best way of avoiding death is to live a meaningful life. And the best way of leading a meaningful life is leading a life according to your values, not your goals, your values. And so one of your challenges, and a big one to perhaps take away from this session, is what are your top three values? And they could be anything from being brave to being healthy, family. It's whatever it is for you. What are your top three values? And if it's hard to work that out, do a big list and then try and work it down to the top three and live your life according to those values. So every time you have a major decision to make, run it through your values. Because if it's not in accordance with your values, you are going to have a miserable time, because those decisions are the ones that will always end up meaning that you're going to have a rough time around it, because they're outside of what's true for you. And so, long answer really to the dream question. And in the dream, I would suggest that being ill will make us think about people who've died and will make us fear death in some way.
Thank you for that. We have another question here, which may be too long to answer here, but do we know which other species dream apart from humans? And I would just like to say that dogs definitely dream, because
exactly.
One of my dogs has real running dreams. You see his legs going. And on the day that he goes to his hydrotherapy, he has swimming dreams for a couple of days. And you can see his legs moving differently. It's very, very sweet. So
yeah. But
do we know about other species? Do we know that? Has there been much research done into primates or cats or dogs or anything?
I don't know enough about this. And this is definitely going to be one of the episodes on the Dream Boat podcast, because we're going to look at dreaming in animals and what is known. Because obviously any of us who've got dogs, I've got a lab, and like your dogs, Lucinda, I really know when he's dreaming. And he'll bark and he'll woof in his dream. Sometimes he'll growl. So, you know, if you think about this, for us, when we're dreaming, we are often reliving the dream. It's a form of reliving our daily life. It's a form of psychotherapy where the psyche or the self, or, you know, is trying to understand what happened that day and work on it and program it in some way. And it seems that dogs definitely do the same. I think cats do. I used to have cats and they used to dream.
I'm going to take you back to your book for a bit, just before we do our 3-minute exercise. Step 6, I really want to talk about this, too many wasted words. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What do you mean by too many wasted words, which to a writer sounds like anathema, but then to an editor, and that's my other hat, sounds like a very good thing.
Exactly. Well, you know, I feel as if I've sort of been talking at 19 to the dozen currently, and I'm hoping that each word has counted in some way. But very often it came out because I said something without thinking during this retreat. And I was shocked that I had hurt this woman. I'd said something, which in our family is a bit of a joke, but for her wasn't. And actually, as a psychotherapist, you realise that we need to listen more than talk. And we do often say things that we regret. And if we just slowed down and listened more and watched what we said, a lot of misunderstanding would often not occur, and we would be not wasting so much energy. I never forget my first yoga teacher used to say, and I'll perhaps do this as part of the 3-minute breathing space, and just check where your tongue is in your mouth, she would say while we were lying in Shavasana, which for those of you who do yoga knows it's the final death pose. And she says, if it's between the top of your teeth, it is a prelude to speaking, she would go on. She said, the tongue is an overused organ. It wastes a lot of energy. Just allow the tongue to drop into the base of the mouth. And I became fascinated by this because it was so true. And it holds a lot of tension in your face. And so although I know I'm doing a lot of talking, it is nice to spend time in silence and just, you know, not always feel that you have to say something.
Well, I'm very, very glad that as my interviewee, you are doing a lot of talking, because that would be extremely difficult if you decided to go through a silent phase. We have a lovely comment here. I think you are right that one has to live in accordance to their values. I will buy your book, Laura. It has something for me, judging from what you have said.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you.
Would you like to take us through your 3-minute breathing?
Yeah, let's do it, because it is... You can see the child in me. It was fun.
I hope everybody is prepared. I don't want to do this on my own, everybody. You've got to join in with this. Whether you're on Facebook Live, whether you're on Goldstar Zoom, please join in with me now.
Yes, they're right. Vipassana retreats are fabulous. A silent retreat, if you ever, you know, is really good. I often do silent weekends and things for people. Such a wonderful journey. But even if you just award yourself a silent day at home, it's gorgeous.
That was a comment in the chat from somebody bigging up the Vipassana retreats. Now, I've not done one, but Laura obviously has. So I now feel like I've missed out. Maybe I should look.
So let's have a 3-minute breathing space. So let's, my clients, I say, adopt the position, because they know what that means. But so let's just settle back on our chair. And let's just close our eyes and find our feet flat on the floor. And allow the floor to come up and meet your feet. And allow the chair to hold you. And so the 3-minute breathing space might be a little bit longer because I'm going to have to talk you into it. But it looks like an hourglass. So for the first minute, the hourglass is going to widen out. And then it's going to narrow for the second minute and then widen back out for the third minute. So for the first minute, just pay attention to being here on the chair, pausing, stopping. So let's tune in first. We're going to tune into 3 things. Let's tune in first to the body. So again, notice where your tongue is in your mouth. If it's behind your teeth, see if you can let it fall into the bottom of the mouth. And then tuning into your eyes. Are they busy looking at the internal screen? See if you can just soften them and let them fall, allowing the eyes to settle. And then just tuning now into your jaw, top jaw, bottom jaw. Just noticing any tension, whether you're clenching your teeth, and just softening the jaw. And now, the next thing is, we are going to just scan the body. So this is, the body scan is a big thing as part of the mindfulness movement, but so just scan yours now. Just noticing any bracing, tension, tightness, and just paying a bit of attention to it, noticing it. Not attaching to it, so looking at it without comment, judgment, or criticism. You've scanned your body. Just name now an emotion to yourself. What are you feeling right now? See if you can identify it as an emotion. And then just notice your thinking. And just notice the thoughts that are in your head right now. And then let them go. You are not your thoughts. So you spent the first minute scanning your body and your emotions and your thoughts. And now you're going to narrow the focus of the hourglass for another minute to just watch your breath. And I always think the best way of doing that is feeling the breath coming in cold in the nostrils on the in-breath. And warm in the nostrils on the out-breath. Just staying with that for a while. And if any thoughts come in, just let them go and return to the breath. The breath is the anchor to the here and now. Now for the last minute, let's return to the here and now, noticing yourself on the chair, scanning your body again, taking that breath and perhaps breathing into any tightness or bracing or tension, using the breath as the healer breath. Noticing how you feel right now. Noticing any differences. And then when you're ready, coming back into the room.
Well, that was gorgeous. Problem is, when I'm interviewing somebody and I think I'm going to fall asleep, it's not a good thing. We've had comments already. I've absolutely loved this interview. Thank you both so much. Thank you for an interesting session. Fab interview, loved it. Wow, people have really, really enjoyed this.
Thank you.
Laura, it's been a joy having you here today. I have put in the chat the link to buy Laura's book. You can go to her website, which is, Laura, do you want to tell us your website address?
Oh, it's Laura Payne, payne.co.uk. He's a bit of an upgrade, so yes, that will be happening.
And here it is, Under the Lime Tree, 9 Steps to a Mindful Life Without Meditating by Laura Payne. Thank you, Laura. You've been a wonderful interviewee. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you on. We've already had 2 messages to me asking if we can get you back on again. So perhaps we need to get you onto Purpose, Passion, Grit, our sister show on a Tuesday, and you could come and talk about the Asclepian method or something to do with it.
Yes.
But thank you
so much. Thank you. It's been lovely. Thank you for all your fabulous comments. And I wish you stillness and presence in your mindful life.
Thank you, everybody. That was the end of the recording. I'm just going to tell everybody on Goldstar what is coming up next. Just first thing, for those of you who came along to Book of the Month in January, wasn't that wonderful? Prime of Miss Jean Brodie by Muriel Spark. Fantastic how much it really engaged people. This is our next one, Lessons in Chemistry. We've got a new one. We try to go back and forth between classics and modern. Have you read this one, Laura?
I haven't. It's on my hit list. It looks gorgeous. It's had good write-ups.
I have had it recommended by so many people. Wonderful writer, Bonnie Garmus, debut novel in her 60s, and she's getting loads of praise for it. So please do join me. This is not till the end of the month, of course, but just so that you can get reading. And this is what's coming up tomorrow. Julie Summers, some of you may recognise the name. She was one of our very first Goldstar authors 2 years ago now. And she's coming back, and she's talking about this book, Jam Busters, also known by by the name of Home Fires because it inspired the TV series Home Fires. And she's going to talk to us about what it was like to have her book turned into a TV series. And do remember, of course, as I've put in the chat, that you are invited, cordially invited, next Thursday in person as well as online. For those of you who want to, limited number of tickets, so do email concierge@goldster.co.uk if you haven't already sent a message in the chat to Jo with your name and your email address, you and a guest, or you on your own. It's totally up to you. It's in Fulham in West London. Thank you. We're running out of time. It's been wonderful. I will see many of you tomorrow. Laura, have a fantastic rest of the week and weekend. Take care, everybody. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Goldster podcast, where we aim to bring you great interviews to expand your world and to keep you curious. Please look us up at www.goldster.co.uk. That's Goldster spelt G-O-L-D-S-T-E-R. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast.